with Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode number 553 of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Now, today I'm joined by an expert in all things nutrition and history because we're going to be asking the critical question, are calories even still relevant anymore, or are they like so last year? We don't know. Well, what got me onto this wild and crazy thing was reading some of the beautiful quotes from our guest, and that is Dr. Helen Veit. She is a historian of American food in the 19th and 20th centuries. That's wild. An associate professor of history at Michigan State University. And she just published another book. It's called Picky: How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. Little pains in the, well, anyway. So we kind of let it go with that. She is absolutely a scholar in this subject, which is why I love this so much. And she's been writing on food history for a variety of academic journals. And of course, she's been in the New York Times, the Atlantic, Washington Post, and all over the place. Helen, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
All right. So, you know what to say. If you don't know history, you're condemned to repeat it. So we're going to figure this out one way or the other. So I'm just like trolling along and doing my thing. And then I read this article in the New York Times. Is America breaking up with the calorie? With the subheading, long held up as the big benchmark of nutrition, the calorie is losing its clout in the age of GLP-1s and a sharper focus on nutrients. So it starts out with this whole thing about, you know, 100 calorie packs that are out there and the history of Weight Watchers and rot-row, they filed for bankruptcy in May. Things not going well. And then all of a sudden, here we have your beautiful quote that made me say, I got to talk to her. Okay. And that was, the stranglehold that calories have had on our culture is loosening. They are just not a great way for most people to relate to eating. And counting them is a fundamentally unsustainable way for people to have a healthy or joyful relationship with food. Whoa. Okay. So where are we going with this one? Helen, we're going to take a step back. Tell us the history of this calorie thing.
Okay. So I first did my PhD almost 20 years ago at Yale University. And at the time, studying food history was kind of a weird thing. I got a lot of, you know, side.
You didn't have
looks.
A lot of friends at the time. Right.
It was just sort of an oddball topic. But I was really fascinated in the way that American food became like it is today. Because Americans have a very unique relationship with their food. We tend to be really number oriented, both about our food and about our bodies. We think about ounces, we think about portion sizes, we think about clothing sizes, we think about the number on the scale, we think about BMI, we think about all these numbers, and of course there's calories. I was really curious in the ways that Americans had developed this very modern, unusual, and I think not particularly joyful relationship to food. So when I was doing my dissertation years ago as a graduate student, I started looking at the emergence of nutrition. Modern nutrition science as we know it really emerged just over 100 years ago in the early 20th century. And it really had two pillars. There were two parts of it that were just what held it up and what caught popular imagination. One was vitamins. Vitamins were discovered in the early 20th century. And all of a sudden, people could say, oh, different foods contain different nutrients. They do different things to our bodies. If we have a disease, it might be because we're deficient in this certain vitamin, or, you know, also other nutrients like protein and niacin, they joined this idea of nutrients. So nutrients were super important as a discovery. But the other pillar were calories. Calories are just a unit of measure. They're like the equivalent of a teaspoon. You know, they just measure something. And what they measure is heat, energy, in this case. They'd actually been around for a long time, since the early 19th century, but no one had thought about applying them to food until around the 1890s. People first started saying, hey, it turns out that food has different levels of energy. This is so obvious to us because we all grew up with this as the wallpaper of our minds, but people had not known that foods had different levels of energy, or as we would say, calories, until they started to measure it around the year 1900. And it really changed how Americans related to their food. One reason that it did is because Americans' food and their bodies were actually changing. This was the era of automation. This was the time when automobiles were invented, trains and trolleys were becoming more common, buildings suddenly had things like elevators and then escalators. People were walking less. It was also a time of urbanization. More and more Americans were leaving their farms and moving to towns and cities and eventually suburbs, and they were moving their bodies much less. At the same time, they were eating more. Food was more abundant. And for the first time really in modern history, having excess weight became a mainstream problem. 1920 was really kind of a hinge where before 1920, if you look in newspapers or magazines, you see ads for things like, are you underweight? We can help you gain weight. Don't worry. We can make your hips larger. Really, you see ads like this.
I kind of see those ads. You know, it's sort of like, whoa. But, you know, the other thing with the calories, too, wasn't there a time in history when once it was discovered that calories were this measure of energy, that when they were applied to food, it was to be able to make certain that those who had less food, the poor, et cetera, were able to access foods that had higher energy so that they could maintain healthy weights and as well, you know, health and well-being. So it was actually kind of used in a public health sense too for whatever period of time to be able to help people until the Industrial Revolution took place. And then all of a sudden our bellies were residing in another state. Okay. So that's kind of the way I saw it as well, right? Makes sense?
Yeah, there was definitely interest in like, oh boy, it turns out we need a certain number of calories. We have to make sure people get enough. But it got twisted in all sorts of ways. Like, for example, fruits and vegetables have very few calories. So if you read this advice that was going to poor people, you know, in the early years, early 1900s, they're saying things like, do not waste your money on fruits and vegetables. You should buy the highest calorie foods you can. You should buy bread. You should buy chocolate before you should buy an apple because it's so high calorie.
Well, I actually have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah,
but
it's actually great.
You know, we're just gonna put that aside for a second. No, but your point is so well taken. It's how it was applied and the messaging that went along with this. You know, now we look back and we say we're horrified, like, whoa. But you know, part of this is I just have to say, you're a historian. It's just wild to see what we believed over the years. And how we were misled by the lack of that, by the gap in knowledge base by both the medical field, the public health field. Obviously, you know, the food industry is a whole different ballgame, and you'll get into that as well. So continue now. And here we are with our little bellies hanging out. We're just turning into a mess, and suddenly calories are like a thing.
Yep. One fascinating thing is they become popular so quickly. Nutrition, it still is today. I think of it as the most popular science. It's the branch of science that the most numbers of average people feel empowered to talk about. They feel empowered to apply to their own lives. It actually, one result of this is that mainstream publications, you know, newspapers, will often publish the results of small nutrition studies because they know people are interested. Of course, the way science works is that any one small study is usually not that revealing. And you'll get these headlines like, cherries are essential food for health, or, you know, it turns out we don't need something we thought we needed. And so average people get this sense that like, oh my gosh, nutrition's crazy. Like no one knows what's going on. They get the sense that it's zigzagging all over the place. And that's partly because it's just so popular. They're hearing about these small studies that are showing these interesting findings. Whereas if we were talking about like molecular biology or something, they're also, you know, sometimes publishing small studies that have these interesting results to the microbiologist, but no one else hears about them or cares. So nutrition has always had this really popular appeal, and calories were a huge part of that from the beginning. But calories were all over the place already by the 1910s. Like you read any women's magazine or lots of advertisements or menus, restaurant menus from the beginning started publishing calorie counts. Often, as you say, it wasn't about weight loss early on. It was about like, oh, I can get, this is the best use of my money. I can get the most calories for the least amount of money. But yeah, they had a popular place right away. But then again, as I said, 1920 is the sort of hinge. So by the 20s, if you think of the roaring 20s and the flapper, weight loss just zooms into mainstream culture. So that by the 1920s, this idealization of thinness that we still have today, it's gotten a little more complicated recently, but this idea that thin is beautiful, and also that thinness has moral meaning. I think that that's one of the reasons that thinness has stuck around for us, is we have this sense that if you're thin, it reveals something about yourself. It reveals self-control. It reveals maybe social class. I mean, it's obviously highly linked to money and education today because it's expensive to eat healthily today. That's one of the tragic consequences of our modern food system. This idea that thinness is both beautiful and something else, it means something. That has been around for 100 years.
Yeah, you know, it's, whoa, you know, as I think about it, one of the things I love about history, I'm going to, you know, be thoroughly transparent with you. Okay, I slept through history when I was in junior high, high school.
It's like, I did God, too.
Get me through this. It's mm-hmm. like, you
I hated
know,
it in high school. I mean, I had a few good teachers, but yeah. I would have died of shock if you told me I'd be a history professor when I was 16.
Well, you know, we didn't quite, I mean, you're a kid, right? And so when they say things like, let's look at the Ottoman Empire, let's go out in the play yard and just, you know, kick ass out there for a while. So, I mean, I would cram for each of the midterms and finals and obviously score my good grades and everything, but it was a grind. It was like, oh, please God, let me get this over with. This was like a box I had to check. And then really, truthfully, it's only been in about the last 10, 15 years that suddenly I've pulled a 180 and history is so rich. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. It's because I think that before all of us can cast judgment on anything, before we, you know, finger point about anything in our life, do you really know the backstory? Do you know the history? And is there only one history? Oh, heck no, there isn't. Because, you know, history is seen through multiple lenses, which is why I like reading a diversification of sources. So that works well for me. And now I'm utterly fascinated. I'm always asking like, well, what was it like 50 years ago? What was going on, you know, 100 years ago, especially as it relates to women? You know, this is the Herb podcast after all. And what were women going through? So to your point, suddenly the definition of a beautiful woman was a very thin woman. And this also hearkened to moral judgments about that person. They're more disciplined. They can kind of hold their head high and they're above it all and, you know, on and on. And it was kind of a crazy time. So then what happened for more like the common woman during that time?
Yeah, I mean, one important thing to add is that not everybody had the same pressures on them or the same ideals. Like looking at African-American people, recent immigrants, a lot of those groups were more insulated from this super idealization of thinness, but it spread. And it spread in part through visual culture. Like this was also an age when movies were starting by the 1920s.
Magazines,
print culture in general, photographs were just getting more common. It became easier to compare yourself against other people visually. At the same time, in the past, most people had just made their own clothes. Like you'd get a dress pattern and you'd measure your body and you would make clothes to fit your body. But
that's a really important point.
It really is, because all of a sudden, by the 20s and 30s and 40s, some people are still making their own clothes, but increasingly you're buying clothes that are pre-made and you have a size. And of course, everybody's bodies are different shapes. You know, like even if you're a size 8 or 12 or whatever you are, like, you know, probably your shoulders are narrower than somebody else's. Like, we're all different. And suddenly you're comparing yourself against a kind of standard every time you go to buy clothes. Like, oh, my shoulders are too big, or oh, my arms are really long.
And then you think there's something wrong with you because you're not fitting, as it were, the mold.
Yes.
You know, there's a specific mold.
Right.
And so that put even more pressure on a woman going forward. I think that that point is so important because I remember reading about people doing their own clothes and back and forth. Oh my gosh. And to think that, you know, it was seen as cool that you can actually fit into something that one of these, you know, uber thin models could get into.
Yep. Yeah. It's really important. And it just leads to a lot of unhappiness. Like right away, you see it in the sources. You see people saying, you know, I will never fit into the newest styles. I can never be beautiful like the movie stars. And you see movie stars themselves dieting like crazy by the 20s and 30s. And these really extreme short-term diets, like the grapefruit diet, where you're really just living on grapefruit. I mean, it's incredibly unhealthy. You're miserable because you're not getting any food. You're not getting nutrients.
And they also go to the spas. You know, this is when a lot of the very expensive spas started showing up, especially in California, where the celebrities would go and drop a bunch of weight before they had to do a movie or whatever the issue may be.
Yep. There were also cures that weren't just dietary. There were amphetamines. I mean, there were drugs, like weight loss drugs in the 20s and 30s.
Wait, wait. Are you talking about Valley of the Dolls? Yeah. That's, you know, it's like uppers, downers, round and rounders. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, people did it all the time. Airline stewardesses had to adhere to a certain look, weight, and, you know, they were measured all the time. So, you know, the black beauties, the amphetamines became a thing with these, at that time, they were called stewardesses.
Yep. And also some kind of wacky, like they had, you could send away money and they would send you like a massaging belt that had like, that you would plug in and it would like jiggle on your body. And supposedly that would like help you shed weight. All these fad diets and these crazy cures, because people, they were so interested in losing weight. But of course, the biggest thing, the biggest single tool was the calorie. That was what increasingly over and over again in American culture, weight loss diets go back to the calorie. In part because if you're talking about short-term weight loss, calorie counting works. It's actually really effective. Like if you're counting calories and you adhere to it really strictly for a short-term diet, you can often lose weight if you're counting calories. The problem is that our lives are not about short-term diets. Our lives are about our long-term habits. They're about what is sustainable to us and what's joyful to us. And that is where the calorie again and again fails.
Well, also, it spoke to quantity, not quality.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, I mean, there's a Big Mac, and then there's a little turkey sandwich made with whole wheat bread. Maybe they're both the same calories, but boy, oh boy, you know, the quality. So I think we didn't really swing over to the quality of calories fast enough. I think we were just sitting around counting them.
Right. Yeah. And of course, and you can also be, and I think it actually encourages malnutrition. If you can have really low calorie diet, if you're doing the grapefruit diet, but you're not getting a diversity of nutrients, you're not getting enough of all of the things you need to be happy and healthy. So that's
some of the most malnourished people are people who are obese.
There's that too. I mean, that's one of the many, and one of the many problems with our modern food system is that obesity is often correlated with malnutrition, or with just a lack of good nutrition, but it's also often correlated with hunger. And that's one of the biggest ironies of all, is that people who are poor in a modern America, who are food insecure, who often don't know where their next meal is coming from, or sometimes don't, they are often most likely to be obese. We have this hidden hunger today where they're getting like, you know, they have all of the misery of food insecurity. At the same time, they often are bearing this cultural stigma against obesity and this kind of bigotry. It's a preventable problem, but it's one that we as a culture really have to reckon with.
In the article itself, there was a great piece that I absolutely loved. And that was not so long ago, maybe about, maybe 6 or 7 podcasts before you. I had Marion Nessel, one of my dear friends.
Yeah.
So she was on, and she was also in this article along with you. And in it, she said, look, you know, calories definitely count. You just shouldn't be counting them. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, well, wait a minute now. What does that mean? And so apparently as an experiment, she went out to dinner with a couple people and back and forth, and they were all asked to estimate the calories that they were consuming at this restaurant. And they were off by God knows. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of calories, because even the great experts can't get it quite right one way or the other. And then the question is, you know, here we are. We have intermittent fasting. So we have people who are eating within certain windows, maybe eating within 10 hours and then not eating for 14, which is a very, very natural way to eat, you know, if you want to be like a cavewoman or something like that. But it really works. I love that stuff. But then are you really counting calories? And the researchers who did the original work, and that's at the Salk Institute and USC, what they actually found was that you don't have to, because just by limiting the window, you're already limiting the total number of calories. And so how cool is that?
Yeah.
So then you got that. But, you know, flashing forward with calories, one of the things I'm going to ask you after the break is, where do we stand today? What would we tell someone today about the role of calories in their health and well-being nutrition pathway? The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. All right. So where are we today? All right. We saw how all of this sort of built up over time. What would you say to someone in the age of Ozempic, you know, and the GLP-1s and Wegovy and Zepbound and all these new drugs popping up? Have calories become irrelevant because people are just basically depending upon a drug to kind of rein it in? And are people actually today still counting calories?
Okay, that's a great question. It's a really big question, too. Americans today, most of us are overweight. About 2/3 of American adults are overweight, and more than 40% of adults are obese. Those are numbers that are totally unparalleled in human history. I'm someone who considers myself really body positive. I accept and embrace the fact that we come in all different sizes and shapes to a point. One argument of the fat positivity movement is that obesity is natural. There's nothing you can do about it. I've heard arguments that it's timeless. That's just false. That's not correct. Obesity as something that affects large numbers of people is really modern. It's a modern phenomenon that results from our really modern and unusual food systems. It's also not totally benign when it comes to health. You can't know what someone's health is from looking at them, whether they're fat or thin or in between, but obesity is correlated with all sorts of chronic diseases and various cancers and heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Doesn't mean you have those if you're obese, and it doesn't mean you don't have them if you're not, but it is correlated with it. Many people who have obesity don't want to. They want to lose weight. And I understand the appeal of these GLP-1 drugs, as well as bariatric surgery. I understand the appeal. However, I am deeply saddened by the fact that so many Americans are eager for these drugs specifically, which in essence take away your desire to eat and the joy that you feel when eating. I think there is a third way that we're not talking enough about, which is trying to cultivate a much more historically sound, long-term, proven human relationship with food, which has to do with cooking and eating with friends and family. It's a joyful path. It's one where you're not counting calories, but where if you're eating mainly homemade food, you're much less likely to overeat in the first place. And you're less likely to cook. Yeah. Well, cooking is a very important part of it. But now, of course, this is very hard. I can imagine readers or listeners hearing this and thinking, I don't have time to cook. I've got a full-time job. I've got kids. I've got all these commitments. Or I don't know how to cook. It's too intimidating. I don't know how to do that. The thought of having to meal plan is overwhelming. I get that too. But that doesn't mean that as a culture, we can't reprioritize. There are tools out there. One of them is home economics. I'm a big fan of teaching cooking in public schools.
I think that's a brilliant idea. It's absolutely brilliant. We should circle back to that. We could call it something else instead of home economics. I would just say healthy cooking. Eating. Yeah, yes. Healthy eating, cooking, whatever. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. No, home economics, it's an awkward, old-fashioned title. We don't need it. But we should be teaching this basic life skill through public education.
Well, the same thing goes with money. You know,
yes, people, financial literacy and knowledge, absolutely.
You know where we're going? Where we're actually going with all of this conversation is something really brilliant. And I'm so glad you brought it up. Because we don't teach people how to live. We just don't teach them. You know, we sort of throw them out into the wilderness and say, you know, have at it and good luck.
Yes.
We don't tell them how to manage their money. We don't tell them how to nourish themselves. We don't tell them how to exercise, to get optimal sleep. How about all the tools in the tool chest for stress management? These are all the pillars of longevity. Yet we don't teach them that.
Yep.
And what we do is we throw them out there and say, figure it out. Well, that's just not working anymore. And I think the calorie thing sort of opens the door to that conversation.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think cooking is incredibly important. And it has to do with what we think of as fun. You know, if you think of cooking as a chore and as drudgery, then if you have a couple of hours at the end of your day and you're tired, you're going to want to sit on the couch or you're going to want to watch a movie or look at your phone or do anything other than cook. If you've grown up cooking, if you feel comfortable in the kitchen, you've experienced the satisfaction and the creativity that you can get through cooking, you might say, you know, I'll go ahead and I'll cook for tomorrow. I'll go ahead and, you know, meal plan and meal prep for tomorrow. I've got the ingredients because I already grocery shopped. These kinds of systems that are really possible to institute in your lives, once you get them going, all these virtuous cycles result from them.
Well, you start having a ritual in your life instead of a grind. And that part of that is reframing the entire process.
Yes.
And the problem isn't, you know, people walk around and they say, my goal is to drop 20 pounds, you know, and to improve my glucose score and blah, blah, and all these things. Okay, those are admirable goals, you know, rock on, okay? What about the systems that are currently in place that support funky habits? What about the systems that have to be created to be able to support the pathway toward achieving the goal? Just saying the goal doesn't mean it's going to happen. You need a system behind that, which is where calories come in. Calories were always part of the system. Count those calories, you know, and back and forth. And there are still calorie counting people out there in a big way. What do you say to those people?
I would say that if you are eating largely food that you've cooked yourself or that, you know, family members have cooked, you are just likely to get fewer calories. especially if you're not using a whole bunch of highly processed foods to make it.
That's the point. You know, I mean, if you're throwing together mac and cheese from a box, that's not going to, you know.
Yeah, it is important what you cook with. And a lot of this also has to do with not just the pleasure of cooking, but what we think of as delicious. This is really important because I would never advocate that people eat food they hate. That sounds terrible to me. And I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think that's something people will do over and over again for years. But how do we inculcate an appreciation for healthy food? I'm in no way a purist. I love to eat because I find it just deeply pleasurable. But I've also, my family, we eat a lot of food that's made with plants, that's made with vegetables and grains and beans and nuts and also some cheese and dairy and eggs and, you know, occasionally some meat. I don't have an ism that I adhere to strongly, but having this kind of a diet as something that everyone in your family likes, I mean, that's a superpower.
Let me take you down memory lane. When I was hosting the National Body Challenge for the Discovery Network, Discovery Health Network, this was a show where we took families from around the country and we worked with them, and they came from multiple ethnicities. And we basically were going to try to teach them about physical activity, nutrition, you know, healthy lifestyle, the whole thing. And in each case, the families were already off the rails. You know, the kids were already overweight, not always, but there were some. And then the parents were definitely off the rail. And I will never forget, as long as I live, we usually shot the series in Los Angeles, which is where our studio is. There was a beautiful Hispanic family, and that Hispanic family really, really wanted to improve themselves. And they ended up teaching us so much. I'll give you an example. For physical activity, do you think you'd find them in the gym? Nah. You know what they'd love to do? And they really started using it as their go-to for physical activity? Dance. Of course. It's joyful. It's fun. The kids would dance with the parents. The parents danced together. And it turned out to be just crazy. You know, they'd do Zumba. They would do all kinds of wild and crazy things. So we were looking like, you know, forget the gym. That's the first thing. The second thing was an eye-opener. So we went to their home and we went into their refrigerator, their pantry, and we literally tossed out all the stuff they had been using. Everything from lard to whatever. And instead, the very well-meaning people of the Discovery Health Network showed up with grocery bags of, you know, kale and all kinds of very kind of interesting vegetable choices and protein choices, fat choices. And we felt so virtuous when we left, like, yes, you know, they're going to crush it now. Instead, we were about 20 minutes out on the road going back to the studios because we were at their home. And we got a phone call. Hi, this is, you know, the mother of this family. I don't know what to do with any of this stuff. I don't even know what it is. What is this Q-U-I, you know, quinoa? Obviously, and back and forth. I don't even know how to cook this stuff. We had a moment. We had to pull over to the side and go, uh-oh. What we did was we got an expert who worked with foods that honored their pathway, not ours. How dare we put ours in their path? We could teach them about a few things here and there, but we ended up cleaning up our act on that one. And what I'm really trying to say here is that we need to take a moment and understand that we have a very different culture now. It's a very hybrid culture in many respects. And people cook differently. They honor food differently. Look at the Japanese, for God's sake, and the way they approach a meal, which is all but sacred to them. And that little phrase they oftentimes say before they have a meal, these are especially true, the Okinawans who are like 100 plus years old, and they say, stop before full. Just stop before full. Just little guidance, advice, things like that. Now, let's go back to the calorie again. Calorie, all right? So what would you say to a woman today who's trying to clean up her act? She's in her late 40s, early 50s. And she's saying, okay, I'm off the rails. You know, I've just been throwing stuff in the microwave and I'm tired and whatever. But I realize now, for a host of reasons, I have got to address this issue. So what would you say? What is your guidance about the use of calories?
Yeah. So I think having some basic understanding of calories, like how many calories are in the foods that she might normally eat, that can be really useful. And it can be healthy to have a sense like, oh, this has this many calories. But I am not ever an advocate of counting calories, but I am an advocate of eating differently. So, you know, if you love a certain product and you can see the calorie count, one rule is that if it has a calorie count on it, it tells you how many calories are in it, then in many cases it's processed because it's in a package or a box. And processed food, by definition, is often more calorie dense, which means it has more calories in it. And when you eat it, it takes more of it to fill your stomach. You're eating more before you feel full than you do with something that's not highly processed. So that's just a general thing to know. That's really
actually
helpful.
Love that. So, you know, if it has calories, now that's all not true across the board.
No.
Because there are certain things that are quite healthy that have to have the labeling. But, you know, you go in the produce section, where are the calories?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the meat, the fish section, they don't have any calories.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's trying to orient yourself, not necessarily in a like all or nothing way. I'm not a fan of all or nothing. I just don't think that works for almost anybody. But trying to orient yourself a bit more towards that produce section, towards the whole grain section, towards the canned bean section. Those are foods that are going to be filling, and that if you use the right seasonings and plenty of salt, this is one thing. Obviously, blood pressure is an issue for some people, but blood pressure is such a common problem in America because on average, we eat so much highly processed food, and a highly processed food is filled with sodium. But if you're cooking your own food, you can actually add a lot of salt. You can salt to taste. One of the problems is people hear like, oh, salt's bad. So when they're cooking, they don't add that much and their food's kind of bland. But for many people, if you don't have a blood pressure problem, you can salt pretty generously. You want your food to be delicious. That's really important. If you don't
and like learn how to spice.
Yes.
You know, there are a lot of ways to be able to utilize, for all intents and purposes, salt substitutes that sort of really spice and enhance the flavor of whatever you're using. You see this all the time at spa resorts, for instance. They'll always have them on the table and you get a chance to experiment and say, oh, this really kind of does work. But I love where you're going with this.
Right? I also don't think that fat is the enemy. We having some fat, especially like olive oil, but I like butter. You know, having some of this for flavor, you don't want to make your food out of it entirely for every dish. But I think making it delicious to you when the base is grains and vegetables and fruits, like you're going to have a pretty healthy diet. Like you're going to have a pretty healthy outcome. And your calorie count is going to be much, much lower than it would be if you were having the same, trying to get the same meal together from highly processed foods in general. There are exceptions to this, but this is a general rule. Short-term diets are not going to change your life. They're just not. You've got to orient yourself towards long-term habits. And I think the habits have to be grounded in things that make you happy and that are doable. Now, some of these just might not feel doable to people because they require time at a time when families are stretched so thin. But I don't think that means we shouldn't be talking about them. I think we should be saying things like, maybe we should rethink the 40-hour work week. We're living in the most abundant age of the world, in the wealthiest country of the world. Do we really have to, is 40 hours definitely, that's a relic from an earlier historical era. As speaking as a historian, there's nothing natural or timeless about the 40-hour week. Could we have less and get paid the same? This is, might sound crazy to people, but really it's just, this was an invention of like 100 years ago. Like, let's rethink it. Let's have more time to cook.
I really like where you're going because, again, and one of the reasons why I tapped you is you are a historian. You're kind of looking back saying, wait a minute now. Maybe we need to, well, you actually said it at the end of the entire New York Times piece. So Americans have done nothing but zigzag in modern times when it comes to food. For all I know, by the 2030s, we'll all be obsessed with calories again in some new way. What did you mean by that?
I can make no predictions about how Americans will be relating.
Wait a minute. Where's that crystal ball you promised
me? I know. I know. I mean, I just really, Americans have done so much going back and forth on food, especially when it's related to weight loss. You know, whether fat's the worst thing or sugar's the worst thing or some fats are okay or actually it's carbs. We've just been all over the place just in my lifetime. I have no doubt that calories are probably going to come back in some way. I wouldn't say I have no doubt. I'm not at all thinking, you know, we've got the nail in the coffin here and calories are going to be totally irrelevant. I'm sure they're not. Food energy is important. But I think this 20th century way of counting calories, it just has been, by and large, a failed experiment. When it comes to ordinary people trying to live their lives and, you know, trying to count the calories, very few people successfully and joyfully do that for their whole lives. It's rare. I'm sure there are some people out there, but it's rare. For most people, it's a short-term diet solution that maybe they do lose weight short-term. But then when they stop counting the calories, because it's fatiguing, it removes them from the social interaction that would otherwise be the heart of a meal. And it also takes so much time and energy. Like, we have better things to do than count calories. We should be thinking about our children or art or poetry or something else, you know, inventing something. Like, calories have been a real time and energy suck for women, especially. I think there's a better way. There's a way that we don't have to use so much bandwidth on food choices if we can sort of automate better habits.
Okay. I'm going to give you the way I'm looking at it. I'm actually writing my next book, and I'm sort of playing with this. Teaser alert. So this is kind of the way I've always looked at it. When I was younger and my mother would take me to a very nice department store to go shopping for clothes, she always made certain that I learned something that was of value to me going forward as we were doing this shopping adventure. So here's the way it comes down and the way I look at it. So when I walked into the very first department store, I was clueless. I'm like, oh my God, there's the couture section. You know, what is, I had to look up couture, like, what is that? Then there's, you know, a section over here, everything's for sale. What's really happening here? So she would sort of explain things as we went from department to department as she was teaching me. What she was actually doing was telling me how many calories were in each one of those price tags for all intent and purposes. So she said, you see the word couture, guaranteed 4 to 5 figures. Stay the hell away from that department. So for me, that's like, you know, the ultra processed stuff. It's like, no, we're not going to go there. So every time you go into a department store, you don't have to go, oh, let's relearn this again. And let's look at every single price tag. No, you already know. You have a pretty good sense. And then you find the safe places. Let's go over here to a particular designer that really, you know, is more, as it were, midway in terms of pricing. And they have really great stuff and they've always fit well. And they're going to cost X number of dollars typically. I'm going to make up numbers like, you know, you're going to buy a dress for $200. I'm just making it up. So then you know you're safe. You're like, phew, okay, I'm safe. And then do you ever really have to be totally shocked the next time you go in the department store and the dress is still $200? It's like nothing's changed. You know, it's still going to be that little mid-market brand that just works beautifully for you. You're safe. You don't have to obsess whether it's $228.95 or $225. You know, it's just going to be within a range that you find to be safe. Well, I look at food the same way. You know, where are the high ticket items? What are the items? When I say high ticket, they could also be really beautiful and wonderful in terms of magnificent desserts at an expensive restaurant. They're still high ticket items. And so, you know, having a taste of them and sharing it with people around the table, that works. Okay. You can't do that with clothing, but you can certainly do it with, you know, your food. So I got to a point where I'd walk into a restaurant. I kind of knew the high ticket items. I knew the ones, you know, that were fairly safe. I knew the ones that I was quite familiar with. And then if I didn't, then I'd ask a lot of questions. How was this prepared? What exactly is this dish? And then I'd continue to enhance my knowledge base. Do I count every single calorie? Oh, gosh, no. Because to your point, science has now shown that it's not just about how much you eat, it's when you eat it, which is where time-restricted eating, you know, having those windows of time to eat is so valuable and has been codified by published peer-reviewed literature and studies. So suddenly there's a when factor, there's a quality factor, right? And there's also a, are you matching it with physical activity factor? If you're just sitting on your ass all day, no. So if you get sick, well, not sick, if you break a leg, say for instance, you can't eat like you were out there rocking and rolling like you normally are. You got to rein it in because there has to be more of a matchup, you know, between physical activity and nutrition. So that's kind of my thrust. It's much more, it's kind of a soft, welcoming thrust. But to your point, everyone out there in the Herb Podcast land, you have to do a little homework in the beginning. You got to know, look it up. Look, come on now. We have apps that literally you could take a picture of food and it'll slap you right back with the calories, the macronutrients, the whole gig. You have wonderful ways of being able to educate yourself if you have any question whatsoever. We didn't have that 100 years ago. We've got it now. So you turn yourselves into little calorie-focused smarty pants and then relax. It's sort of like, I'm in familiar territory. How many times do you have to make a three-bean soup before you figure out that this is perfectly fine? And, you know, it's so filling because of the amount of protein in it that you won't eat, you know, a vat of this. You will have what you need. Slow down your eating, savor, enjoy, add all of the things that you've just said, Helen.
I think that's fantastic advice. It's not that people shouldn't have some knowledge about either calories or certainly nutrition. I think it's really important, actually. As I said, I think we should be teaching it in the schools. I really think it's so important that once you have the knowledge, step back and allow like a really bird's eye view to come into play where you're thinking about the foods, how they work together. You know, everything is generally healthy and you have treats. I'm a big advocate for treats sometimes. I think if you're depriving yourself all the time, that's mentally fatiguing. Can't do that. Like a little treat sometimes is just what the doctor ordered.
It's just perfect.
Yes,
absolutely.
Exactly.
You've got to have that. Now, you've published a new book. It's called Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. Give us just a quick synopsis of what this book is about so that when they run out to get it, they know what they're getting.
Yep. So this is a book that's based on more than 10 years of research, which was all inspired by this question, this amazement that I had when looking at historical sources from the 19th century, because kids ate so differently back then. American kids in the 19th century were eating shellfish and organ meats and all sorts of vegetables and coffee and spicy sauces and vinegary pickles and this whole range of foods. And they weren't only eating them, they were loving them. And it wasn't just kids who were poor or who didn't have enough food. Kids of all socioeconomic backgrounds were seen as curious, omnivorous food lovers. How could this be? Because aren't kids supposed to be naturally picky? Don't they have special taste buds? So I dug into this question and I discovered that in the history of our species, kids have never been picky eaters. That's a really modern invention that is caused by a bunch of factors in the present. You know, highly processed food is a big one. It's one of the biggest, but it also has to do with our ideas about psychology and our modern fears that we'll mess kids up if we try to teach them to like different kinds of foods. It's a really hopeful book, I think. It's about our amazing capacity as humans to learn to love different foods. It's a book that's ultimately about pleasure. One of the biggest ironies, I think, is that parents think they're being nice parents when they give their kids special foods and cater to, you know, what they see as their special needs. But in reality, it creates a lot of dislikes. And that's not inevitable. As much as, and I know many of people listening probably were picky eaters or might be picky eaters today or their kids are, but that is not the way it has been in our species. It doesn't have to be this way.
Where can they find this? Everywhere, right? Amazon?
Yeah, it's all over.
The whole thing. Okay, so it's Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. And everyone, we've been talking to Dr. Helen Veit. And she is the author of this fabulous book and others. And she's also a historian of American food. We have tapped you as a repeat offender. We're definitely going to have you back because I could listen to you all day and so could our entire audience. But unfortunately, we can't do that. So all I can say is, thank you, Dr. Helen Veit, for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you so much.
All right. And I want to thank my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, rooted in nature, and the new Her Life Stages products. Scope it all out at solaray.com. Take a moment now, leave us a review, because we love to hear from you. Oh, that rhymes. Maybe I've got a poetry thing in my future. So this has been a production of Podcast Health. Yay to the team. And remember, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you could do with that time, not counting calories, are not. So get on out there and enjoy a meal. Cook. Have some joy around what you put in your mouth, for crying out loud. Get that healthy food happening right now. Thanks for listening, everyone.